Film Spotting is brought to you by the new PeerFlix.com, a fun place to get movies for less.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Sam Van Halgren.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. The 79th Annual Academy Awards are just a week away. Tonight, we'll tell you who will win and, more importantly, who should win the Oscars, and will look good doing it. I'm wearing JCPenney. Sam, you look
Goodwill,
resplendent.
I think
the Gap is what it looked
Gap
like.
Gap sweater from the Goodwill.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll also have listener feedback, Massacre Theater, music from Dan Byrne, and a review of the Oscar-nominated documentary Jesus Camp. But we'll start with Toni Collette, Brittany Murphy, James Franco, and more in The Dead Girl.
Do you think you could give me a ride to Norwalk? My daughter lives there. Tomorrow's her birthday. She looked just like me. Oh my, not crazy. There's a dead girl. I found her.
You're the reason those bloodsuckers are out there swarming all over my yard.
I just told them about the dead girl.
Found her. So what? You keep walking. Keep your mouth shut.
She had cuts in her hands, right? Her clothes were all cut up too, right? You know, like bras and nylons and underwear all cut up.
Why did he do it?
Probably something to do with his mother.
Karen Moncrief's The Dead Girl interweaves five stories connected by, wait for it, a dead girl.
Dead girl.
The first thread, The Stranger, has Toni Collette discovering the girl's body. The sister suspects that the girl is her sister, who was abducted as a kid and whose absence still consumes her family's existence. The wife just might be married to the sociopath who killed the girl, and the mother puts together the pieces of her estranged daughter's shattered life prior to her death. Finally, there's the dead girl herself, a strung-out but dreamy-eyed prostitute played by Brittany Murphy. Sam, a cynical critic might call The Dead Girl a gimmick film. We've certainly seen the interlocking ensemble approach employed a few times this year. Babel, Fast Food Nation, Bobby come to mind, along with recent movies such as Personal Velocity and Crash. And as it just so happens, you gave positive reviews to all of those films.
Ooh,
so,
interesting pattern.
Is The Dead Girl another effective use of the gimmick, or Exhibit A in the case against screenwriters and directors who might be considering the gimmick?
Yeah. Well, to me, this is less a gimmick like those films you mentioned, and more, I think, a new breed of film that is really practical, actually. I mean, young filmmaker trying to raise a buck, needs stars in the film, doesn't know how much time she or he has to make it. How about I make five films, really, that are under the guise of one? And that's exactly what we have.
You're
here.
Even more cynical than I thought you could be, Sam.
Well, no, honestly, I think it's very practical. And the thing is, and I think there are some good and bad qualities to this. First of all, if one of them doesn't work, you've always got the next one. Mm-hmm. That's fine. But what I think where the problem lies, and it's not structural, it's how a film like this likely is sold to an actor like Marcia Gay Harden or Toni Collette or Giovanni Ribisi or Josh Brolin, whoever. I have a feeling, and maybe this is where my cynicism rears its head a little bit, they're written to be very attractive to actors who want to act. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost like they're these actor showcases that people that can't get a break on Broadway or anywhere in New York, they do these showcases where they invite agents. And it's just like, let me strut my stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, Giovanni Ribisi needs an intervention. It is getting ugly. It is getting ugly out there. He needs a David Mamet intervention. Stop with the funny voices, Giovanni Ribisi. You look good. You're ripped now. Good for you. But and the fact is, like, the first segment, the stranger sequence with Toni Collette as this woman, disturbed young woman, with none other than Piper Laurie playing the mom, the abusive mom.
Uh-huh.
We've seen one too many of those. Is really awful. I think it's awful. I think it's a terrible, terrible segment. Toni Collette has never been worse. I love Toni Collette. I feel like she's miscast. She has to play this kind of mentally damaged young woman who acts out these really bizarre fantasies. And I never bought her. I never bought her as being either dim-witted or deranged or whatever she's supposed to be. Like I said, Giovanni Ribisi is completely absurd in the segment as well. And I think in even the second one, I didn't like the second segment all that much either. And it sort of clouded my judgment. But as I looked back, really the film does get better. The latter segments are pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
The last two, in fact, with Marcia Gay Harden as the mother of the dead girl, is pretty good. She really spends the bulk of her segment interacting with her her now dead daughter's roommate, sort of junky roommate, played by Kerry Washington, who's really good.
Yeah.
Marcia Gay Harden's good. And then the final scene with Brittany Murphy. I really like Brittany Murphy. Mm-hmm. I think she gets away with something that few actors do, which is like she plays a character. She puts on the character. You can almost see her doing it. And then I think she sells it.
Yeah.
I think she really does sell it emotionally. So I can't really say that I recommend the film. Maybe it is more or less a gimmick, but it's not a complete waste of
it. Well, I do recommend the film, and I agree with you about Brittany Murphy, who I didn't like the character she put on in Sin City. Loved it
here.
Really thought she did sell it, and it works here. And I think just first of all, you have to ask yourself, are you invested in the story, any of these stories, but the larger story that's going on? Do you want to see how these stories interlock, how the girl died, what effect her death is having on these characters? And I did want to see. And what I was also really impressed by was the way Moncrief kept everything, for me, from feeling preordained, as if, you know, you're just kind of trudging along on this inevitable tragic course where, you know, things seem kind of planned out in a way. And the dead girl is the only exception to this. Of course, we know where that story is going, right, where Brittany Murphy's story is leading. But I thought really the emotional and the psychological revelations in each story were interesting, including the dialogue, including the acting. Aside from just the plot stuff, I really thought it went in interesting directions that I felt like I hadn't seen before or felt were new to me. I thought it was really interesting. And this is a movie very specifically for Moncrief about violence and about violence against women and the way it shatters lives. And I never felt like Moncrief trivialized that she put these characters in situations just to fit into this larger scheme, like a certain Best Picture nominee I won't mention. So I thought that was all interesting, and I like to
babble for those uninitiated.
I like to the way the film was really fascinated by codependency. You know, it's every chapter is marked by a relationship where one person can't live without another, or who depends on another, or is let down by someone that they are depending on and should be. And the body just kind of prompts these characters to come to this realization. So I actually was surprised by how much I did enjoy this film.
Yeah, and I like to, upon further review, I like how each segment, really how the dead girl does make these people sort of come to a realization about their own lives and to an embrace life in some way, even if it is in a disturbed way.
Not in a sentimental way.
Not in a sentimental way, I agree. I do feel like certainly the first couple segments are flawed in that what takes place, the action that takes place, like this day is different from any other kind of thing. There's no reason they wouldn't have taken place before. It's not like Toni Collette, in her case, is just like finally gets fed up with her mother because of the dead girl being involved. I don't quite buy that.
Okay.
Or the young girl who believes she's found her sister. The dead girl is her sister. The fact that this would be the time where she blew up at her parents. And again, I know that because they think she thinks it's resolved in some way. I know, but
I bought all of that.
What she actually does in terms of like tearing the pictures off of the wall.
You didn't
far, I didn't buy that. That wouldn't have happened much, much earlier.
Okay. No.
That being said, that's less of a problem.
I bought this
as the film goes
this
on.
Moment as the impetus for all that stuff. So it worked. I like the look of it too. Just want to close by saying the blacks and the yellows, there's a lot of starkness to it, and there's subtle differences in the lighting and the design and the approach and all the sequences, I think, is interesting without being too in your face. So the dead girl, currently playing here in Chicago and in select cities around the country, and it will be released on DVD in May.
One popular thing to do in American politics is to note that the summers in the United States over the past few years have been very warm. As a result, global warming must be real. What's wrong with this reasoning?
It's only gone up 0.6 degrees.
Yeah, it's not really a big problem, is it?
No. I don't think that it's gonna hurt us.
If you look at creationism, you realize it's the only possible answer to all the questions.
That's exactly what Dad said.
Mm-hmm. It's the only possible answer to all the questions.
There's an interesting connection between Jesus Camp and fellow documentary feature Oscar nominee An Inconvenient Truth. And Jesus Camp directors Heidi Ewing and Rachel Grady's handling of that connection, what do evangelical Christians think about global warming, as maybe you get an indication of in the clip we just played, offer some valuable insight into what they hope to accomplish with their film. The movie tries to answer the question, who are the 80 million Americans that describe themselves as evangelical Christians? It chooses as its subject a Christian summer camp for parents and kids run by one Becky Fisher, a Pentecostal minister who might describe herself as a general in the cultural war currently being waged in the United States. Adam, although the directors don't explicitly state their agenda, or maybe they do, I guess it depends on your definition of explicit, the movie certainly isn't objective journalism. In fact, it can pretty safely be called a liberal rallying cry. How does this lack of objectivity impact the movie, or if we are indeed engaged in a cultural war, should Jesus Camp be filed under propaganda?
Well, that's a good question. I don't think there's any doubt, though, that the directors want to appear impartial and objective, and they try really, really hard to pull it off, and I give them a lot of credit for that. I think anybody who argues that this film is blatant anti-evangelical propaganda saw a different movie than I did,
I
at
totally
the very
agree.
Least. But they undoubtedly have a point of view, and yes, it bothered me because they just can't be as transparent as they want to be. Throughout the movie, you could see the conflict bubbling up under the surface, the eerie music and the editing that
the music,
become
right.
more frantic when the kids get more and more caught up in the spirit. It gives everything a real sinister feeling, so they're clearly commenting on it. And the way they incorporate the commentary from Mike Papantonio, the host of Ring of Fire on Air America Radio, he's against the evangelicals and is clearly there to be the voice of reason. He more or less always gets the last word because they kind of use his segments as punctuation points, as transitions to the next chapter of the story. And near the end, they try to make his segments fit in the rest of the story by having this call between him and Becky Fisher, who you mentioned. And to me, the whole thing feels staged.
Totally
it feels
staged.
Like the call was
a
staged.
A lot of the film seems staged. Yeah,
it feels like it was there just to justify his inclusion in the movie at all. And then by the end of the film, the directors have completely thrown in the towel. Over the end credits, we get a couple of scenes where we see two of the main characters, two of the main kids we follow. One of them is a young boy with a lot of talent for preaching, or will have someday, named
and an
Levi.
Intense rat tail.
Yeah, and that's true. And then another girl whose name I've forgotten, but we see them out on the street basically proselytizing, and they go up to, and this is, again, just over kind of the end credits, but it's there. They have to throw it in at the end. They go up to a group of black men sitting in a park, and she starts talking to them about Jesus Christ and stuff, and then she walks away saying, I think they were Muslims.
Yeah.
And then right after that, we get a scene where they're standing on the streets, and they wonder why everyone is looking at them so kind of despondently and irritated and ignoring them, and they're like, it's like they think we're selling something. What could we be selling? And here, we're laughing at them.
Yes.
We're laughing at these kids now, how misguided and naive they are, because we know exactly what they're selling, and the fact that they can't see it is funny, but of course they're kids. And those scenes serve no other purpose than to mock those kids.
They show so much restraint in this film. You're absolutely right. And the fact that they couldn't go the distance and show really total restraint, it just makes me think that they just have no respect for their potential audience.
Yeah.
It's just like, or I wonder who the sort of models for their kind of documentary are, because clearly, yes, they have an agenda, but it sort of distorts their obvious curiosity about this group, you know. And I really appreciated how, for the most part, they really did choose individual subjects that are articulate, sincere, passionate, didn't undermine them by labeling them as hypocrites or having some evil agenda. I think they honestly wanted to bring attention to the liberal audience out there that this is, if we want to set this up and use the language of the film, the enemy in the cultural war. I'm not putting myself on either side. I'm just saying, like, that clearly was the agenda of this film. And I just wish they had respect for that potential audience to say, like, literally, this is who those people are. I'm not going to tell you how to feel about it. And you're right. The music is just, it really, really bothered me, because
me
it's the most manipulative part of the film. Really, you have these shots of going through this middle American town, and it's this droning synthesizer that's really saying, like, evil lurks here.
It is.
And you don't know middle America. This is what middle America is breeding. And I just feel like, for the most part, I really like Becky Fisher in terms of what they allowed her to, this Pentecostal minister, really allowed her to speak her mind.
Yeah.
And you don't feel like she was taken advantage of in any way.
No, and in fact, it seems to be the case that she is happy with the way she's portrayed in the film,
That's really encouraging, and that makes the whole film a lot more interesting. And it just would have been more interesting if they had trusted, you know, the audience to make up their own minds.
I agree. I think if Passion of the Christ was essentially what a lot of people thought, a Christian snuff film, I think Jesus Camp is the secular snuff film. It's the secular version of that, because in the end, it doesn't seem as interested at all in explaining the reasons behind the rise of this movement or the political repercussions of it as it is with simply scaring the hell out of us blue staters.
Oh,
you know, there's scene after scene meant to just scare the hell out of you. And in that way, it does succeed. And we played the clip coming into this review of this scene between this mom talking to her son Levi and just saying these ridiculous things about science and global warming. And that whole part is there, I think, to just get, as you said, it's preaching to the choir, you know, no pun intended, where it's using this language and these scenes to get the secular base all riled up against these type of people.
But also and to write these people off in some way, yeah, and to not take them seriously, even as it is, yes, threatening the Blue Staters with the impending doom of what an America run by the 80 million evangelicals will become. And I just feel like, it unfortunately does sort of contradict itself with its own sort of intentions and execution.
I exactly agree completely. And it actually is out now on DVD. One of the reasons we are reviewing the film is not only does it tie in with the Oscars, it is an Oscar-nominated movie, but it is out on DVD. So if you are interested, you can run out and check it out.
If you've seen The Dead Girl or Jesus Camp and agree or disagree with our takes, or if you have any other thoughts you'd like to share, please email us at feedback@filmspotting.net or give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a voice message.
When we come back, Film Spotting listeners prove their pretentiousness with praise for David Lynch's latest mindbender, Inland Empire, and share their picks for the most deserved Oscars. Stay with us.
Lady next door gives a balcony, opens up a door and goes inside. Sun dropped down just minutes ago. Western sky smear cranberry light. Normally the things on my mind that go down deep, I would not let them run without a fight. But I stand in another man's clothes tonight. I stand in another man's clothes. I guess that's what happens. Guess that's how it goes when you stand.
Hey Adam and Sam, this is Kate from UIUC calling in about the Oscars. One of the categories that I follow every year as a musician is that of best score. And this year I'm a little concerned that the Oscar may go to Babel or The Queen, but the nominee that I think is most deserving is Pan's Labyrinth, which has had a beautiful and haunting and very memorable score, in my opinion. So I guess we'll just have to wait to see on Oscar night, but I'll definitely be rooting for that one.
Welcome back to Film Spotting on Chicago Public Radio with Sam Van Halgren. I'm Adam Kempinar, and that was a voicemail from Kate here in Chicago with some thoughts on her pick for what should win Best Original Score.
I'm glad somebody's paying attention to that,
No kidding, because we are not. We are not going to get into the scores here on this show, but we are going to give out our awards, who will win, who should win, the major categories later in the show. But I thought this was an interesting category. She singles out Pan's Labyrinth. Right. I certainly remember the score and did like that score a lot. Did you have any scores, Sam, that really stuck out for you? The nominees, real quick, I'll mention Philip Glass's score for Notes on a Scandal, Babel, The Good German, Pan's Labyrinth, and The Queen. I actually liked all of those scores for me, Philip Glass's score in Notes on a Scandal was just completely overbearing.
I think it's misunderstood, honestly. I'm not going to get into it, but Gustavo Santaolalla's score for Babel is just incredible and just as moving and memorable, really, as his score for Brokeback Mountain was last year. So certainly, I just can't wait to hear it. Actually, during the Oscars.
Okay.
Just to be brought back.
That's what you're looking forward to most. Okay,
exactly.
Well, thank you, Kate, for that voicemail, and we'll hear a few other listener voicemails later on in the show. Let's get on now to our poll questions. Last week, we asked listeners on our site, filmspotting.net, because we're completely forsaking all of the bad
I was going to say, to go
releases.
From Oscar talk to the talk of the films currently in theaters that are not nominated for Oscars.
Yeah, the absolute dregs. Which February release looks worse? And Sam, the choices were Ghost Rider, Hannibal Rising, Music and Lyrics, and Norbit. How did it come out?
Boy, Eddie Murphy. Let's just hope that the people that are answering this poll are not also
members
of the Academy. 50% of listeners said that Norbit would be the worst-looking film currently in release here in February, followed by Ghost Rider at 25%, 15% Hannibal Rising, and only 10%. The Hugh Grant, Drew Barrymore film, Music and Lyrics, which we agree looks the most watchable of these four.
Yeah, definitely. So this week's poll question, relatively straightforward. The Oscars are coming up. We're talking about them on the show, of course. Which film should win Best Picture on February 25th? And the choices, Sam, are
Babel, The Departed, Letters from Iwo Jima, Little Miss Sunshine, and The Queen.
So,
of course, we'll get to our picks later in the show.
We will, and we want to know what you think. Go to filmspotting.net, vote in the poll, and make your voice heard. And speaking of making your voices heard, we heard from a lot of our listeners this past week in response to our review on our last podcast about David Lynch's new experimental mindbender, Inland Empire, which I believe is still playing at the Music Box here in Chicago, if you have a chance to go see it. And let's go ahead and jump into the mailbag, Sam, and start with one of our listeners who thought it was brilliant.
Yeah, Aaron Simler in Freeport, Illinois, who writes, "Hey guys, guess Sam is going to call me pretentious, as I suggested last week, saying any critic that called Inland Empire the best film of the year was verging on pretension, something we get accused of all the time."
Yes.
"Hey guys, guess Sam is going to call me pretentious, but I thought Lynch's Inland Empire was not only the best film of 2006, but along with Mulholland Drive represents a towering achievement in post-millennium American cinema."
That's the most pretentious sentence that's ever been uttered on this show.
Ever been uttered. "I never once found myself bored during the entire 3 hours. Quite the opposite. I was so utterly transfixed by what I was experiencing, I wanted more. Yeah, the film treads ever so closely to the edge of self-parody, but Lynch never falls into it. Part of the reason is the anchoring of Laura Dern's performance. The film is as much hers as it is Lynch's. She is funny, raw, heartbreaking, intense, fascinating, beautiful, and not afraid to get down and dirty for Lynch. Much the same could be said for the film itself." Aaron Simler, Freeport, Illinois, is obsessed with Laura Dern.
Apparently so, and rightfully so.
And rightfully so, she is fantastic.
A tremendous performance there. And John Colletti here in Wheaton, Illinois, also in Illinois, was equally as transfixed by the film as Aaron was. John writes, "Inland Empire is in many ways similar to its predecessor, Mulholland Drive, in the sense that it manages to shock and ignite the senses through a series of powerful images involved in a confusing and incoherent plot. But if Mulholland Drive was the ultimate example of a dream put onto film, then Inland Empire is its nightmare counterpart. Just like the nightmares we can actually remember, it had a disturbing Burroughs-esque grittiness thanks to Lynch's amazing use of digital video and felt like a random vortex of shocking brutality, repulsive humor, and other strange images that we know only the most deranged, hidden elements of our psyche can produce. And best or worst of all, when all these elements are mixed together, it creates a sense of dread that we will never be broken free of the tremendous hold it has on us."
Pretension breeds pretension.
It does,
as we can see. But
you can't argue with how articulate and passionate
our listeners
the response
are.
Is. I know.
Absolutely. No. And here's one who actually doesn't agree, didn't have a great experience with it, but is actually claims even more pretentious than anyone else.
That's true.
And that's Jared Medeiros writing from Boston, who writes, "Okay, how can I say this without sounding pompous? Maybe I can't. Having graduated with a Master of Fine Arts in Video and Film, I've created, sat through, and critiqued many single-channel films and videos. I really enjoy experimental film and video, both narrative and abstract, and I appreciate any art that is open to interpretation and exists mainly as something that evokes a feeling. So I'm not one of those Inland Empire haters that was expecting something coherent. I was just expecting to enjoy myself and be intrigued or stimulated in some way. There were definitely scenes and ideas in the film that did just that, but as a whole, it doesn't work for me. It's good to see Lynch working with video, but 3 hours in that format was just too much. I still think of him as a genius, and I can't wait to see what he does next. Lynch will be happy, Jared, to hear it."
He will, and I think you can basically put our response to the film, which we did discuss on our last show, right in the middle of those people.
Yeah, I agree.
We don't think it's a masterpiece. We don't think it's the best film Lynch has even done.
Certainly compelling stuff.
We're also more startled by it and engaged by it than Jared was. So again, thanks everyone for the feedback there. And we do also want to read a couple of responses to last week's top five, which was top five most deserved Oscars, the times when Oscar actually got it right, because we always do rip on them for making bad choices. And we got a really good one here from Jose Ferreira in El Duderino, Portugal, who says,
"What an amazing place name.
I know, it sounds great, doesn't it?
Real. El Duderino?
You think he made it up? Number five, Ang Lee, Brokeback Mountain, winning for Best Director. Number four, George C. Scott, Best Actor in a Leading Role for Patton. Number three, Unforgiven, which was on my top five, Best Picture in 1992. And Jose says, the last truly great movie to get Best Picture. Are you going to argue? I may
Without
not.
Having the list in front of me, I am tempted to agree with him.
I am too. Number two, Annie Hall, Best Picture in 1977. And number one, Sunrise, Best Picture. Janet Gaynor for Sunrise, Best Actress, and Best Cinematography in 1927. Yes, it's that good. Was the first and only film to win the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences Best Picture Award in the category of Unique and Artistic Picture. The other Best Picture category was called Most Outstanding Production. The next year, the Academy instituted a single award called Best Production. Interesting choice of words. No, and this is significant because Sunrise is a masterpiece that we've overlooked, and we will not overlook it because it is going to be part of our next marathon. We're in an animation marathon right now, but we will be doing silent films next, and we're very much looking forward to Sunrise. So thanks for that list, Jose.
That's right. right. We've got one more here from our good friend Brett Merriman, writing from Menlo Park, California. His top five that Oscar got right. Number five, F. Murray Abraham in Amadeus. Number four, again, Unforgiven, Best Picture in 92. Number three, Diane Keaton in Annie Hall. This performance defined women in the 1970s. It still defines Diane Keaton.
Well said.
Well said. I love Diane Keaton. Number two, Jane Fonda in Clute. Shame on you guys. I've heard you wax poetic about this one. The best performance of Fonda's career, one of her best female performances ever, and the Oscars had the balls to give the award to Hanoi. Jane, another good pick.
It
the
is.
Only reason it missed my list last week was
you didn't
that
go back that far.
I didn't. Well, no, I just wasn't familiar enough with the other nominees.
Okay.
To be fair. Great performance, though, I agree. And number one, Robert De Niro in Raging Bull. There's Brando in On the Waterfront, and there's De Niro in Raging Bull. Enough said, right,
and
Brett?
It is enough said,
and
Brett. And I'll just mention quickly an email from a listener, Tara Byatt, who wrote in and said that she felt compelled to respond to the top five because I mentioned that the Academy got Ordinary People right in terms of 1980, the acting categories, recognizing Timothy Hutton.
Right.
In general, 1980 was a good year, except for Best Picture, when Raging Bull should have won instead of Ordinary People. And she writes in with a really articulate defense of Ordinary People. The fact is, I love the film Ordinary
right.
People. It's been in numerous top five lists for me.
But
I just think
Raging Bull,
Raging Bull is a better film. So that's really the end of that.
That's right. Well, time for another quick break. When we return, your shot at a free DVD in Massacre Theater, and Adam and I let 10-year-old Abigail Breslin know if she deserves a Best Supporting Actress Oscar. Inappropriate dancing to follow. Stay with us.
And I saw Marlon Brando on the big screen like a hero. Made me act and feel like one too. For 3 or 4 hours, felt like no one could touch me. I skidded back to feeling like I do. I'm lost, crazy, lonesome. A plane with no place to land. And I do what I have to make me feel like a man. Make me feel like a man. I was 22 years old, my daddy was 70. I didn't know how a young man's supposed to be. A few years after that, he breathed his final breath. There's some secret he forgot to whisper to me. I'm lost, crazy, lonesome. A plane with no place to land. And I
my server is going to send you to the showers early.
Right, right. So to get back to what we're discussing, the failure of the country to get behind New York City is anti-Semitism.
Max, the city is terribly run.
But I'm not discussing politics or economics. This is foreskin.
No, Max, that's a very convenient out. Every time some group disagrees with you, it's because of anti-Semitism.
Don't you see the rest of the country looks upon New York like we're left-wing communist Jewish homosexual pornographers? I think of us that way sometimes, and I live here.
You're listening to Film Spotting on Chicago Public Radio. It's time now for Massacre Theater, where we absolutely destroy a great screenplay.
I take pleasure in it.
And you get a shot at a free DVD.
On the last Film Spotting podcast, Adam and I massacred the scene you just heard coming out of the break from Annie Hall, a tie with last week's top five as we discussed the picks that Oscar got right. Annie Hall beat Star Wars, among others, for Best Picture in 1977. Adam, reach into that Film Spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
Well, I'll do that in a second, but first, So many people commented on your Woody Allen impression, Sam. I'm tempted
impeccable.
To play it again.
Boy, it's
here.
Tempting. I know, really. People will just have to go back and dip into the archives.
Yeah, it really is funny, too, because the gamut of responses from people saying...
Horror?
It was just the worst thing I've ever heard. The worst
tempted
Woody
to throw
impression.
Their iPod underneath the train,
yes.
I remember reading
to
once.
To the people
yeah.
that genuinely congratulated you for a good impression.
Best acting performance yeah. in Massacre Theater over, what, 150 shows?
Yeah, it just shows you how subjective acting really is. And it is true. We talked about this. We picked Annie Hall because it's a good Oscar controversy. 1977, beating Star Wars. And I just want to quickly share some listener responses. Brad Barber, South Pasadena, California, said, yes, it deserved to win Best Picture. He remembers being shocked to hear it beat Star Wars when he was 12, but later seeing it and realizing why and being glad he'll never get tired of it. And also Andrew Sorcini said, yes, the Best Picture that year was Annie Hall over the overhyped yet still fun Star Wars. But then there were people like Gary Angelo in Granite Bay, California, who wrote in and said, funny you should choose Annie Hall as the Massacre Theater scene. It's one of my first Oscar memories. I remember as a 10-year-old kid in 1978 sitting in front of the TV confused that it beat Star Wars for Best Picture. Annie Hall? Annie Hall? What? How could anybody think there was anything better than Star Wars? Ever. Unbelievable. As an adult, I can better understand the choice, but as much as I love Annie Hall, the kid in me is still not entirely convinced that it should have taken home Oscar that year.
I just love picturing like the 10-year-old just perplexed
what?
At the choice of the Academy.
This is crazy. Yeah. That's
this
probably
is
what
crazy.
He said. Yeah. Okay, well, it is time to announce the winner, and the winner is Stanley Nguyen from Fountain Valley, California. Congratulations, Stanley. Email feedback at filmspotting.net, and we'll set you up with the DVD of your choice.
The other day, when I heard Mr. Fabian tell Miss Channing that her understudy was going to have a baby, and they'd have to replace her.
And you want to be Margaret's new understudy?
I don't let myself think about it even.
It's time now for this week's edition of Massacre Theater. And Sam, we've made it pretty easy on our listeners the past few weeks.
We have.
It's not going to be as easy this week. No. I am throwing down the glove right now. It's a challenge.
I didn't even get this, and I love this film.
That's true.
That's true.
That is a good
but
point.
I'm quite bad at Massacre Theater.
But this could be even worse than your Woody Allen
funny
impression, though.
Funny voices.
Yeah, we love funny voices. You're playing a woman. I'm playing a man in the scene, and it ties in with the theme of this show, the Oscars. This is from, we can say,
yes.
an Oscar-nominated and potentially an Oscar-winning screenplay.
Okay.
Okay, so that is the connection, and Sam, you start it, so I'll give you the action. And action.
Tell me, what was Greta Garbo really like? Did you get to know her?
Yes, I did, actually. She's coming to stay with me next month.
Tell me, how much longer are you going to go on making films?
I suppose that rather depends on how much longer the public wants to see me in them.
Yes, it must be hard to know when it's time to throw in the towel. What a pity about that last one of yours. What was it called? The Dodger?
The Lodger.
The Lodger. And it must be so disappointing when something just, you know, flops like that.
Yes, it is. Rather disappointing.
And
scene.
Sam, I am in the zone.
You redeemed yourself. You redeemed yourself big time with that one. If you know what film Sam and I just massacred,
Sir
email.
Sam Van Halgren?
Sir
it's got a
Sam
nice ring
Van
to
Halgren,
it.
Yes, it does. Email feedback at filmspotting.net. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on our next show. To listen and to get official Massacre Theater rules, just visit filmspotting.net. It's time for Film Spotting to jump on the Hollywood hype train.
That's
time
right.
to make our Oscar picks. We're going to tell you who will win and who should win the major awards. Of course, you're hearing music from the movie Dreamgirls, which did get snubbed.
Conspicuously, you know, not nominated for
Best Picture nominees, but was not a disappointment to us.
No,
we did not love
not.
The film by any means. But that is our cue, Sam, that we are now ready to hand out our awards. And let's go ahead and start with Best Supporting Actress. The nominees in this category are Adriana Barraza from Babel, Kate Blanchett, Notes on a Scandal, Abigail Breslin from Little Miss Sunshine, Jennifer Hudson from Dreamgirls, and Rinko Kikuchi from Babel.
Yeah, I mean, I'm getting this feeling that Dreamgirls just isn't really getting a lot of love as we get closer to the big show, but I don't really think that'll impact Jennifer Hudson's chances. I didn't really like Dreamgirls, as we mentioned. You didn't either. And I didn't even think that Hudson's performance, really, as the arrogant and powerfully voiced Effie, was all that special. But her singing performances were still some of the most memorable moments I had in the theater all year. I think I still have chills from, and I'm telling you I'm not going. They're still there. You can see them. If this wasn't radio, I would show you. The rest of the performances on the list I really like a lot, too. The tough decision for me was choosing between Adriana Barraza and Rinko Kikuchi in Babel. They're both incredible, I think. But really, I had to remember what my impressions of the film were walking out of the theater, and it really was Barraza's performance as Amelia, the Mexican nanny who puts her charges and herself in pretty grave danger as she leaves San Diego for her son's wedding in Mexico. I think it's a really outstanding performance. Let's hear a bit of it.
I raised these kids since they were born. I take care of them day and night. I feed them breakfast and lunch and dinner. I play with them. Mike and Debbie are like my own children.
But they are not your children, ma'am.
I mean, it's just a wonderfully human portrait. But I think what's interesting thinking about the film is that she never foreshadows the pain she's going to be put through, which just makes the experience of watching her suffer all the greater. Your pick, Adam.
My pick, I am going, I think, with conventional wisdom here. I do think that Jennifer Hudson is going to win. I think that's a lock, and I would give it to Jennifer Hudson, even though I had a great conversation this morning with our mutual friend and Yale-trained actor, Kevin Rich, who said there's no way you can give it to Jennifer Hudson. He echoed what you said during our review of it, which is, just because you have a great voice doesn't mean
you don't give
you deserve
an Oscar to a voice.
An Oscar. Right. And it really is tough for me because, without a doubt, my runner-up choice would be Abigail Breslin from Little Miss Sunshine. That's who Kevin would have given it to. But I am siding with Jennifer Hudson because of what you said. When I think about a performance, even though a supporting performance, that holds that entire film
it's
together.
True.
And
yes.
I think she's good even in the scenes that aren't just her big show-stopping singing tunes. I think she's good acting scenes as well. In fact, let's go ahead and hear a quick clip.
Magic Reachable.
I'm done.
Then read it again.
Did you look for work this week, Miss White?
Mister, you can keep asking me that question, but the answer's always gonna be the same. The only thing I know how to do is sing, and since ain't nobody letting me do that no more, no, I did not look for a job.
Have you considered asking the girl's father for help?
Magic don't have a father.
So again, that's Jennifer Hudson. I think she gives the best performance of any of the actresses in the film, certainly better than Beyoncé.
Oh yeah, no doubt.
And her singing performances are amazing. They are show-stopping numbers. They gave you chills. They did for me, too. They made the film watchable, and that, I guess, deserves an Oscar in this
case.
All
right, fine.
Okay, so we are on now to Best Supporting Actor, and Sam, the nominees are
Alan Arkin in Little Miss Sunshine, Jackie Earle Haley in Little Children, Jimon Hounsou in Blood Diamond, Eddie Murphy in Dreamgirls, and Mark Wahlberg in The Departed. Adam.
My choice for who will win, I think Dreamgirls is still going to get some love here. I guess I am going with Eddie Murphy, though I think Alan Arkin could be a sentimental favorite and might sneak in there. I think who should win, though, is Jackie Earle Haley. He makes someone who could easily be seen as a villain very sympathetic, playing Ronnie McGorvey, this sex offender or who has at least been charged with a sexual crime. And he's not so totally sympathetic, though, that we ever completely trust him or feel like we like him or understand him. And I have to give credit to Michael Phillips in the Chicago Tribune, who had a whole article about what makes a great performance. And they singled out moments from films that summed up these great performances. And he had Jackie Earle Haley in there. And he mentioned the scene that by far is the most memorable for me as well, which is the dinner scene he has when he goes out on a date. And actually, let's go ahead and hear real quick, Sam. Let's hear the clip of Ronnie getting prepped for the date by his mother.
Stop it!
Ronnie, just hold on. Now, there. You look handsome. She won't be disappointed.
Wait till she hears about my criminal record.
I don't think you need to get into that just yet. Why don't you stick to small talk?
What if someone recognizes me?
That's highly unlikely. I made the dinner reservation at a restaurant over in Haverhill.
So the dinner scene that follows that, and then the post-dinner scene, which is certainly memorable for it being somewhat shocking and disgusting, but also memorable because you can read about 1,000 different emotions into one look on Jackie Earle Haley's face. I think it's a really great performance.
Yeah, I found this list of nominees pretty uninspiring. I don't think there are any conspicuously bad performances on the list, at least Jack Nicholson wasn't nominated for The Departed.
Mm-hmm.
But none that I found particularly memorable either. And unfortunately, the most memorable supporting role of 2006 was bumped up to Best Actor, and that's Forest Whitaker as Idi Amin in Last King of Scotland. I'm saying instead of Mark Wahlberg, Jimon Hansu and Alan Arkin, again, all good. Where are Philip Seymour Hoffman in Mission Impossible 3? John C. Reilly in Talladega Nights? Or really the always good, and seriously, when are they going to give this guy an Oscar? Paul Giamatti in The Illusionist, mm-hmm. performance we both liked. Yeah, I don't think Eddie Murphy is going to win, actually, for this. I think, honestly, it's going to be Alan Arkin. I just have a feeling. It's a gut feeling about this. Like you said, maybe a kind of nostalgic Lifetime Achievement Award. He hasn't been nominated in 40 years, this great, great actor. Who should win? I agree with you, Jackie Earle Haley. I think it's a good performance. I think maybe it benefits from the fact that he's so unfamiliar. I think it's really a smart move on Todd Field's part to cast somebody as unfamiliar as Jackie Earle Haley is in this performance. He's quite good. For me, not as memorable as some other performances this year, but very good.
Of the nominees, counts, that's where it goes. Well, you mentioned some overlooked supporting performances. I would single out James McAvoy from The Last King of Scotland, who got overlooked, and my number one supporting performance of the year, Ray Winston from the movie The Proposition, really deserve some recognition from the Academy as well, and maybe someday he will. Let's move on now to Best Actress, Sam. Our last category here in this segment, the nominees are Penelope Cruz for Volver, Judi Dench for Notes on a Scandal, Helen Mirren, The Queen, Meryl Streep, The Devil Wears Prada, and Kate Winslet, Little Children. Sam, who will win? Who should win?
Okay, fine, Helen Mirren, you'll get your Oscar. She's a fine, well-respected actress, and you're just fine as Queen Elizabeth II, but honestly, it gives me no joy to say it. And for whatever reason, I know I'm completely alone on this, so she's going to win. Everyone will be happy, and that's just great. At least you were the actual star of your film. I'm talking to you, Reese Witherspoon, who won last year as June Carter Cash in the Johnny Cash biopic.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking of last year I made the really sort of unpopular, maybe surprising choice of giving my Best Actress Oscar to Judi Dench for Mrs. Henderson Presents, a film nobody even remembers,
and
really,
we didn't even
a year
like,
later.
Really.
We didn't even like all that much. Directed, though, by Stephen Frears.
I know.
Director
from
of
The
Queen.
Well,
I'm almost embarrassed to say it because it
you
suggests
be.
An unhealthy obsession. But if it was up to me, based on this list, I would give the Oscar, yes, again, to Dench for Notes on a Scandal. I think she gave the best performance by an actress in 2006. Her performance in Notes, yes, it's this total genre film, this single white female for the working class British set, but thinking about how different it is, a performance from last year's Mrs. Henderson Presents, I think is worth mentioning. But it's a thrilling performance, literally. This is why I go to the movies. One of the reasons why I go to the movies, to see literally kind of thrilling performances. And I think she takes this role, which could very much just be a one-dimensional kind of harpy kind of role, and really breathes a whole lot of humanity into it and cruelty. And she really makes the film work, I think.
And stay with me.
I would if I could. I'm desperately sorry about Portia, but you can see I have to go.
Think very carefully, madam. Be aware of the consequences.
Barbara, please don't make this mean any more than it is.
Stay with me. I don't know what I'll do.
Look, I'll call you, I promise.
They always let you down in the end.
Well, Helen Mirren is going to win. I agree with you there. And I actually do think she should win. And I just refuse to vote for Judi Dench because it's just way too safe a pick. I can't believe
you did it two years in a row.
Sam the Iconoclast goes with the most obvious choice ever.
How is it an obvious choice if Helen Mirren is going to win and everyone knows it? How
because
is that obvious?
Because she's just established
everyone
as
got whiplash
a revered
listening
actress.
To this.
Everyone loves
she's
her.
She's a great, great actress.
She is.
She didn't win last year,
she
though. She had won
award.
Any. I mean, she won for her 10-minute performance in Shakespeare in Love 10 years ago.
I think it's boring. I just
think one of the greatest actors working today in the history of film, really.
Maybe so.
And she deserves to have a Best Actress Oscar on her mantle or in her bathroom, wherever she chooses to put it.
Okay. Well, I'm going to read from a very smart listener, someone smarter than you, Sam, Andrew Moore, Decatur, Georgia.
My job is always at risk here.
I'm going to let Andrew do the speaking for me about why Helen Mirren deserves to win. Sam, I finally got around to watching The Queen, and I wanted to take issue with your characterization
of Helen
Mirren's performance. If I recall correctly, you felt it was more precise than moving. Hello, she's playing Queen Elizabeth.
Something I noted during our review
was the generation gap between her stiff upper lip and Tony Blair's media savvy. She was perfect throughout the movie, and the scene that really clinched for me was the elk sequence. After all the turmoil of that week, she starts to break down, and then she turns to look at that animal. The face that Mirren made melted my heart, and then the armor comes back on. A fantastic performance and a great film, and I really hope that Mirren wins the Oscar for Best Actress. She will, and she should. There you have it. Thank you very much,
Andrew.
I said
it's perfect. It is perfect. It's perfectly boring and precise. Yes,
no.
It's good.
You're
it's
missing
fine.
All the humor.
No
the
humor.
Sensuality.
No sensuality.
Queen Elizabeth.
The
it's
sensuality.
It's bubbling just under the surface,
you're right.
Sam.
It's a hot, hot, sexy performance by Helen Mirren.
It is.
As Queen Elizabeth II.
Okay, I apparently have some issues that we need to discuss during the break. It's time for one last quick break, actually. And when we come back, Sam and I are going to answer the age-old question, how will the Academy screw Martin Scorsese this year? Stay with us.
Now, a couple years ago, I told everybody that I was the Messiah come to save them. They started lining up with babies to be blessed, the sick and the lame blocking the pavement. I walked on water and old kids sang, turned wine into whiskey and drank, drank, drank. Honey,
time now to take a look at what's new on DVD, brought to you by PeerFlix, a fun place to get movies for less. Discover, trade, connect at the new PeerFlix.com. Out this past Tuesday, the other Truman Capote movie, Infamous, the documentary The U.S. versus John Lennon, a Criterion Collection edition of Bicycle Thieves, and two of Sam's favorite films of the year, Marie Antoinette and Half Nelson, are out now. You can watch Ryan Gosling and see what all the fuss is about, plus one of my favorite films of the year, a two-disc version of Martin Scorsese's The Departed, just in time for the Oscars, along with the Infernal Affairs trilogy. You can see the Hong Kong film that The Departed is based on, along with its two sequels. Out this Tuesday, you can look forward to Babel, the Best Picture nominee, for your consideration, a disappointment for Sam and I from Christopher Guest, A Guide to Recognizing Your Saints, which played at the Chicago Film Festival and we liked, along with The Prestige with Christian Bale and Hugh Jackman, and Shut Up and Sing, the Dixie Chicks documentary, directed by Film Spotting Documentaries Marathon alumnus Barbara Koppel. We also want to take a moment to thank everyone who donated to us this week via the PayPal links. We will have your nicknames on the site, and we will read them on the show with next week's group of donors.
And the train gets further and further off the track. And each day passing, it's harder to turn back. They come Mother Earth, Mother, for a reason. She will revolt. Stop. Stop. What you do? Stop. What you doing?
Hi guys, this is Angela from Chicago. And I think that Babel will win Best Picture, but I think that Little Miss Sunshine should win Best Picture. I had the most fun at Little Miss Sunshine, 100 people in the audience having a great time. And when I look back at my movie experiences from 2006, Little Miss Sunshine really stands out to me. I think it deserves recognition for what it accomplished, and I don't think it should be slighted just because it's a comedy.
How you doing? Cute family, it's nice.
Thank you.
Is this on the side, the list? The left.
Yes.
Oh,
sweet. Sweetness.
That is sweet. Yeah.
Welcome back to Film Spotting. We're going to give our picks for Best Picture here in a few moments, but that was Angela.
I was still all worked up from the last segment.
I know you
were.
Now
we get this.
We get this. Ready to just fire you up yet again, Sam. She says Babel's going to win, but Angela says Little Miss Sunshine was the most fun she had at the theater all year.
The
you
bad
shouldn't
movie
be
that could.
Such
yeah.
a hater.
I don't know what to say about a film that I feel like is fairly slight and will be seen. I think I will be redeemed down the line. This is not a film that will be holed up. I can only hope that the Academy doesn't award it a Best Picture show. We don't have to be embarrassed about it in the future. As a nominee,
okay.
We can all ignore it.
Well, I think the Academy is going to overlook it then. It is a film, though, I did like a lot, but didn't come anywhere close to making my top 10. So with that said, thank you, Angela, for the voicemail. And we are now to our picks for Best Actor. Leonardo DiCaprio in Blood Diamond, Ryan Gosling in Half Nelson, Peter Peter O'Toole in Venus, Will Smith in The Pursuit of Happiness, and Forest Whitaker, The Last King of Scotland.
Yeah, you know what? Everything points to a Forest Whitaker win, and honestly, I hope he does win. I love Forest Whitaker, and he's great in the part, and it would be a real letdown for some reason after winning every other pre-Oscar award. He was denied the Oscar, and they gave it to Peter O'Toole for nostalgia's sake or something. So who will win? Forest Whitaker. I really hope it does happen, but who do I think gave the best performance by an actor in a lead role? Gael Garcia Bernal in Science of Sleep, actually.
Nice try.
But he wasn't nominated, so my second runner-up is Ryan Gosling as Dan Dunn in Half Nelson. Let's hear a bit.
Special occasions.
Got a lady coming over tonight or what?
Yeah.
What's like her lot?
She's all right.
She like you?
I don't know. I'm hard to like sometimes.
That's true.
Oh. Oh, yeah, you just gotta, you mash those up. You mash them up to the end. Get in there and squeeze them.
And that's Gosling with Sharika Epps, I think, denied an Oscar nomination herself. We could have had a couple preteens, really, in the nominee race for Best Supporting Actress. She's wonderful in the movie. She's wonderful in that scene. And here you have Gosling exhibiting some of that charisma that made his performance as this crack-addicted middle school teacher so compelling and so believable.
Okay, well, my pick, who will win, you're right. I think it's hands down going to go to Forest Whitaker. And who should win? My favorite male performance of the year, it is Forest Whitaker. Let's hear a scene from The Last King of Scotland.
I'm sorry, Harry. I couldn't hear myself think.
You took my gun.
Yeah.
Who are you?
I'm Dr. Nicholas Garrigan. I work at the medical compound in Maghanbo. I'm a doctor.
You are British.
I'm Scottish. Yeah, I'm Scottish.
Scottish?
Yeah.
Why didn't you say so? I thought we discussed against the Mau Mau. Great soldiers, very brave, and good people, completely. Let me tell you, if I could be anything instead of a Ugandan, I would be a Scot.
Like, really?
Except for the red hair, which I'm sure is attractive to your women, but which we Africans, we find this quite disgusting.
This scene on the street where we first meet Idi Amin, we've seen him perform for the crowd, and he's dynamic as anyone could be, but then this scene where he first interacts with our hero, James McAvoy's character, Nicholas Garrigan, the firecracker that is waiting to go off in that scene is just amazing, and I think that there's so many dynamics to the whole role, but especially in that scene, there's just a roller coaster of emotions that Forest Whitaker pulls off. I think he's brilliant. And I also think maybe, like you, you'd like to see him win. I'd kind of like to see him win just because he's Forest Whitaker.
I've
always liked
totally
him.
Agree.
But I do love his performance, and it is my choice. And someone I'd single out for maybe an overlooked performance, I think he got a Golden Globe nomination for it, and he got a nomination for Blood Diamond, DiCaprio, but I think he gave a better performance in The Departed. I really think he got robbed by not getting a nomination for that role.
All right, we'll move on to Best Directing. The nominees are Alejandro Gonzalez in Iñárritu for Babel, Martin Scorsese in The Departed, Clint Eastwood, Letters from Iwo Jima, Stephen Frears, The Queen, and Paul Greengrass, United 93. Adam?
Well, I think Paul Greengrass is someone that could go to for United 93, which on the whole got snubbed, and also Iñárritu has got a shot with Babel, but I think this is finally the year the Academy is going to recognize Martin Scorsese. They're going to give him the Best Director Oscar. It's his sixth time being nominated, I believe, for Best Director and has never won. They're finally going to give it to him this year for The Departed. And who should win? I got to be honest, this was hard for me because as much as I love The Departed and love Scorsese, I think that United 93 is a less flawed film. I have issues with The Departed, but I think that the issues are mainly
flawed.
It is less flawed. I think the issues with The Departed, though, are actually mainly screenplay driven, more so than the directing. So I'm giving it to Scorsese. I tend to go with what I think is the better picture. The Departed was one of my favorite films of the year, so I'm giving it to Scorsese. What about you?
Well, I think Scorsese will get it too, and maybe that's just wishful thinking and hoping, because even though I wouldn't necessarily give Scorsese the award for The Departed, I'm just privately hoping that, let's just give it to him. Let's just so that we can end this conversation once and for all. He certainly deserves it, whether for this film or for whatever other film. And I think it's just challenging to think about directing. I mean, it really is a mystery in terms of what goes on during the filming of these movies. And the fact is, we would never give an Oscar to a director of a badly written or badly photographed, badly edited, and badly scored movie. I mean, we give these awards to good movies. Mm-hmm. So I have to award the best directing Oscar, in my mind, to the film I liked the best among these nominees, and that is Alejandro González Iñárritu's Babel. I mean, and part of it is just the achievement and knowing what went into it. It's just, it took a film, it took a year to make. He's filming in all these various locations, working with actors where English or Spanish is not their first language or second or third language either. And there's so much going on, and I like the results. I mean, it's ambitious. It's very, very ambitious. The script is, visually it's ambitious, and it worked for me. Mm-hmm. So I have to reward the director for that work.
Okay. Did you have anyone who you'd want to single out that maybe got overlooked? For me, the obvious choices would be Kevin MacDonald for The Last King of Scotland, Alfonso Cuarón for Children of Men, and Guillermo del Toro for Pan's Labyrinth. I think all three of those deserve nominations.
I do too, but for me, it's my three favorite films of the year. Michel Gondry, Science of Sleep, Sofia Coppola in Marie Antoinette, and John Cameron Mitchell in Short Bus. Really, all of those are great achievements in directing, in that really all three of those films are the achievements of writer-directors, really mm-hmm. putting a vision on screen, more successfully, I think, than any of these other films.
Okay. Well, we arrive now at the final category. We are here at Best Picture. We asked you earlier in the poll question, which film deserves Best Picture? Babel, The Departed, Letters from Iwo Jima, Little Miss Sunshine, or The Queen? Sam, I think you've kind of made it known where your vote's going, but who will win? Who should win?
You know, I really think, for some reason, that The Queen is going to win.
Hmm.
I just don't think, even though I think the money may be on The Departed, certainly it's a critical favorite, and certainly just an audience favorite, too, and it made the most money, certainly, of those films on this list. But there's something about how people adore mm-hmm. The Queen, and that it's very stately, and it's successful in its execution, and it's relevant, and all these things. And I just feel like it's going to sneak in there and be the Best Picture winner. Like I said, of these films that are nominated, Babel is my favorite. I know it's not a perfect film. The narrative is a little too ambitious for its own good. At least a third of the movie could probably be lopped off with no harm to the rest of it. But I'm willing to defend the film in a way that I feel like few other people are, and that is the moral lesson of it, which I know you find totally obvious, and that is that in this increasingly small world we live in, there are going to be problems. If we live in such close proximity to each other and don't get to know each other's languages and cultures and religions, and that was interesting to me, and I liked the way it was executed. And by taking these plots to their extremes, and yes, he makes some otherwise innocent people suffer for it, I felt like that's life on a large, dramatic, tragic scale. I was moved by it. I liked the film, flawed though it may be.
Okay, well, it's always nice when you have a flawed film winning your Best Picture, and I actually am in the same boat. But who will win? Well, you had a little bit of a surprise, Sam, for Best Picture, going with The Queen, because Babel does seem to be the front runner. If you were going to put money down, that's where people seem to be going, especially in light of last year's bad choice of Crash, and Babel really is just Crash 2006.
You're unbelievable!
So with that in mind, it seems to be the front runner. But I actually think it's not going to go to The Queen. I think The Departed is going to win. I think finally they're not only going to give Scorsese his due for Best Directing, but his film, which did make a decent amount of money, has that big all-star cast, and I think they're actually going to give The Departed Best Picture. That's my surprise upset choice, and I think who should win? Of course, The Departed, my second favorite film of the year. Let's go ahead and hear a clip from it.
I knew your father.
Yeah? You know he's dead?
Oh, sorry. How'd he go?
He didn't complain.
Thanks. Yeah. That was his problem. There's a man could have been anything.
Are you trying to say that he was nothing?
I'm saying he worked at the airport.
The film, I said when we reviewed it, the most fun I had in the movie theater all year, and his directing of it is just amazing, what you would expect from Scorsese. I think it might actually win, and I think The Departed deserves to win Best Picture. We will see next Sunday.
All right, well, those are our Oscar picks. Send us your thoughts on the Oscars or any other feedback to feedback@filmspotting.net or give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a message. We'll be back next month with more reviews of new and recently released movies right here on Chicago Public Radio. In the meantime, go to filmspotting.net to listen to the weekly Film Spotting podcast.
Our next podcast will be available this coming Friday, February 23rd. We'll review the new espionage thriller Breach with Chris Cooper, an actor we both love, and Laura Linney, an actress we both
don't love.
At least one of us likes. And we'll also reveal our top five most anticipated spring movies. So we're finally getting out of 2006, looking ahead to 2007.
Embrace 2007 with open arms.
Yes.
All right. Well, this radio edition of Film Spotting is presented by Chicago Public Radio with editorial assistance from Christina Stevens and Joe Dassault. Our thanks to Dan Byrne and Messenger Records for today's music. For Film Spotting, I'm Sam Van Halgren.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Support for Film Spotting is provided by PeerFlix, a fun place to get movies for less. More information is available at PeerFlix.com or at filmspotting.net. Meryl Streep, The Devil Wears Prada, and Kate Winslet from Little Children.
Sorry.
Meryl Streep, The Devil Wears Prada, and Kate Winslet from Little Children.
Mirren, Mirren, Mirren. It's it was a Marsha, Marsha, Marsha thing. Is that going to play?
No.
Let's try this again.
Jesus.
It's worth trying. It's worth it for an outtake.
It is. You're right. Okay.